Season 2, episode number 18, Managing Your Mental Health in College and Beyond. Summer is right around the corner and Target is featuring excellent deals. Starting May 20th, get 25% off mountain bikes, select grills, and 30% off home, and you know what? An extra 15% off patio furniture. All summer essentials. And lastly, get a $5 gift card when you spend $15 on sun care. And you know we're going to need a lot of that starting this Memorial weekend. If you love to shop at Target, check out the Target shopping links on my website. Head on over to keepit100girl.com for your weekly discount, or just head on over to the show notes right there on your mobile phone if you're an online shopper like me. And let me back up for a second, because if you don't know where your icon is on your phone and you have an iPhone, you're going to look for that purple podcast icon and you're going to tap it and type in the search field, Keep It 100 Girl Podcast. Look for episode number 19 located under season 2. And if you haven't listened to season 1, you need to back that thing up and rewind and listen to a whole bunch of good stuff. But as of today, you're going to look for episode number 19 to take advantage of these Target sales that I just talked about. It's May, and almost the end of May, but it's Mental Health Awareness Month, as well as college graduation. Graduating, whether it be high school, college, or otherwise, it's a landmark occasion, and it represents the determination, work ethic, and growth that each of you are going through, have gone through, and have it in the near future. For many, it's an understood rite of passage, and it's a matter of when we graduate, not if. But for others, there are obstacles, we all face them, that continuously stand in the way of getting that diploma. This episode, it's real, it's raw, it's unfiltered. Like I come to you guys always, I keep it real, I keep it true on the Keep It 100 Girl podcast. But I'm going to be talking about the most popular mental health issues students are experiencing. And, you know, it ranges from anxiety and stress, which are all universal conditions. It doesn't set us apart. This episode is going to explain that it's a myth to think that you're alone. Because you're not. Mental health, it's a universal experience.
The number one issue is anxiety. And, you know, I think that is due to the nature of just like, why students are coming to school. School is like their job.
So today I decided to interview a dear friend of mine, Dr. Bruce Sterling Wallace, and he's a licensed professional psychologist at California State University. And Bruce has been passionate throughout his career on the topic of mental health. Bruce attended Howard University, where he did his undergrad in psychology, and later did his postdoctoral residency at the University of St. George in Grenada.
My name is Dr. Bruce Sterling Wallace II. I'm currently a staff psychologist at California State University, Dominguez Hills, where I've been working since July of 2017. Prior to that, I worked at the USC Counseling Center. That's the University of Southern California Counseling Center, where I started in October of 2015. And that was my first position after receiving my degree. So most of my training and my career experiences have been in college counseling centers. So I have a lot of experience with the college counseling center and the college population.
Are you ready to keep it 100?
I'm ready to keep it 100,000.
Thank you. So growing up, I personally never thought mental health support was a thingy, especially on campus, where we could even have the opportunity to talk to somebody or go to a counseling center. I never knew it was an option. Maybe I just didn't embrace it, but I guess I was busy. You know, college is a big deal. You're trying to always make the grade, get on top of things, stay on top of things. And gosh, you're starting to adult with your life and you're realizing, you know, the stuff that you know and don't know are really real at this point.
That's interesting that you say that, because like my undergrad degree was in psychology. I went to Howard University and they have an excellent counseling center, like an excellent counseling center. That's where I received my training. And I would pass it every day because it's near the psychology department. But like, I never thought to seek treatment, even though I could have. Like, I have reasons to, but it never occurred to me. And that's also a trend that I'm noticing. Like, there used to be a stigma around seeking treatment, but that stigma has really decreased rapidly, because every counseling center that I've been associated with, that I worked at, that I've trained at, they're inundated with more students than there's a capacity to deal with. There's always a waiting list, and there's always tension around, like, how do we deal with this waiting list? So students, they're coming in. They're not shy to come in anymore. So often they seek us out. For the most part, they seek us out. They seek our services out on their own. And on rare occasions, they may be sent to us by like concerned faculty members or staff members. But for the most part, they know where we are and they seek our services.
And it wasn't until one of my white girlfriends, and this is like well into adulthood, commented about, you know, you, and she's talking to me in a manner like, I guess the underlying tone was like, how do you not function without going to therapy? Like, it would do you a well of good. And, you know, I thought about it and I said, gosh, I viewed it as a stigma. You know, it was planted in my head. And part of, I guess, my culture, my Caribbean culture, like, you just don't talk about your business like that to a stranger, or let alone anyone. And maybe, and I've always had this complex about just not wanting to deal with the demons because I wasn't ready to deal with them until I had to. And now I totally embrace it. I mean, it's different when you're talking to your girlfriends, your best friend about something, but when you're talking to a licensed professional who really keeps you honest and really keeps it 100 at times, did me a world of benefit. And I guess I wish that it's something that I could do on a regular, but again, it's finding time, right? Finding time, or feel like I need to make the time to go and do this on a regular basis. And I've really found someone that I like. So it's just a matter of me making that commitment to myself, and anyone else listening, making that commitment to yourself.
It's not being viewed as a stigma anymore. People are more forthcoming and showing
up. Yeah, most definitely. A lot of the stigma, at least in the past, it's not that you're necessarily going to a psychologist because you're fundamentally flawed or broken. You're going to a psychologist to enhance your gifts, to get the most out of what you have and to get the most out of life. And I think when we don't have a proper understanding of our own unique emotional lives or our own unique ways of seeing life or thinking, it can cut us off from accessing all of our power and achieving all that we can achieve. So I think it's useful to think of it that way, more of a strengths-based kind of perspective, as opposed to, oh, there's something wrong with me and I need to go get fixed.
So I mentioned earlier that I've never had anyone in my circle come forward to openly admit and really be emphatic about it, that I should go. Made me think twice. And as you deal with the heavy weights of life, you know, I had one good close male friend that I worked with, and dude would go religiously. As soon as that clock struck 5 or 5:30, he was out the door with a quickness. And I really admired how he stuck to his therapy sessions, and he went twice a week. In fact, I go to the same therapist because I was like, man, you know, the way that he used to be committed, like, I gotta meet this person eventually. And when I lost my father, you know, she is the one that I reached out to, and I had to, now I totally understood where he was coming from and why he was so committed, because she's good. You know, when you hit that wall and you need to talk to someone who doesn't know you, you look forward with bated breath to that conversation, especially when you're rock bottom with emotions. So I asked Bruce, with all the student population on campus, what are the top 3 mental health trends he sees with college students on campus? Like, Bruce, why are they walking into your counseling center?
I would say the number one issue is anxiety. And, you know, I think that is due to the nature of just like why students are coming to school. School is like their job. And so, you know, there's a lot of stress and anxiety around grades. So the number one, I would say, is anxiety. And then like number two, or maybe even neck and neck, is depression, because I tend to think anxiety and depression are like two sides of the same coin. Like, if you have one, you're gonna have the other more than likely. But I think, in my opinion, anxiety is the driving force most of the time. So I would say depression is up there too. And then like homesickness, kind of, for like either homesickness/isolation, for like freshman students or like transfer students. You know, there can be a sense of like disconnection from their main support group, you know, the family, or like for transfer students, just this sense that they don't really have a place in the university quite yet. So there's this sense of isolation that they struggle with. I would say another kind of like trend, or like something that I've noticed and not a lot that seems to be increasing, which I think is related to like the isolation and the sense of disconnection, is like an increase in kind of like suicidality or kind of para-suicidal thinking. So it just seems like students go there more quickly nowadays. And I think that has a lot to do with kind of just like a sense of isolation, because a lot of times it doesn't feel like I'm sitting with a student that really wants to die. It feels more so like I'm sitting with a student that wants to like, that wants to connect and feels like they can't connect and wants to feel like they matter. And, you know, they don't feel like they matter. And so to others, and so it seems as though they don't, their lives start to not matter to themselves as well. And then like these suicidal thoughts can kind of start to overtake them. And that combined with just like the pressure and the stress of the situation, it seems like more and more students and kind of young people are just finding it harder and harder to manage stress, and become overwhelmed by it.
Another trend is gender. Even though more males are coming in to seek counseling services, by far, females are Bruce's, or I should say Dr. Wallace's, main clients throughout their 4-year program.
Oh, I would definitely say there's more females that I'm seeing that come in, you know, personally. I don't really know the statistics, like center wide at the various centers that I've worked at, but my experience has been like, I would say 75-25, if not 80-20, females to males. Yes, there still is that kind of that, what do I want to say, that negative kind of bias towards like seeking therapy within the male community. But I think that's lowering too, that, you know, I am seeing more and more males come in seeking services, but by far it's more females.
And then like the average, like how often would they come in for a session? Is it something that's just throughout their whole student life?
Well, I wish it could be that way. And at certain centers that I've worked at, it's kind of been that way. There's been like no quote unquote session limits, but most centers just can't do that anymore because of the increase in demand. And so most places that I've worked at, there's a limit placed on how many sessions a student can kind of come in throughout their kind of student career. And, you know, the number of those session limits varies from center to center, anywhere from like 6 to 12 sessions, or sometimes it's a case by case kind of situation. In other situations, there's been like a heavy emphasis on like referring students to kind of like outside community providers, particularly if like their issues are like long-standing issues or issues that you know won't really be resolved or even kind of like get close to being resolved within kind of a limited session time frame. Personally, I'm not really a big fan of diagnosis. Like, if I didn't have to give a diagnosis, I wouldn't, because I just think the diagnoses that we have available to us don't accurately capture really what the unique circumstances or the unique issues that each person's dealing with. So it can kind of like put people in a box, but I understand the desire for it, even from clients.
Dr. Bruce explains how his style of therapy works when he has a new patient that's a college student.
When I start a session, start work with a client or a student, like I like to set the frame and the expectation in the beginning, you know, kind of just let them know that, you know, the work we're going to be doing is a piece of work. It's a short term kind of work that we're going to be doing. And kind of with that being said, it's going to be very important that like our work is goal focused, which I think is a good idea for any kind of therapy, because nobody necessarily wants to be in therapy forever. You know, they want to know that there's a roadmap, that there's going to be an ending at some point. But particularly like when you know there's going to be a limited amount of sessions, I think it's crucially important that your client, the student, knows that up front so they're not caught off guard. But I mean, honestly, that might not always be communicated. And if it's not, that can lead to a lot of disappointment in the student when, you know, time is up.
So what's it like for college and university campuses with this influx of student populations seeking counseling and mental health support? How are they accommodating this growth? Not only how are they accommodating this growth, but the increasing number of sessions on campus.
Yeah, we're continually and constantly thinking about ways to better kind of like suit and match the demand, overwhelming demand that we've been kind of experiencing. So anything from like trying to bolster like the group therapy kind of like program, which can be a challenge sometimes. Like there can be a sense with students that like, I don't want to do group therapy. Like I you know, that they don't want their business to get outside of just the therapist, even though group therapy is one of the most effective ways to kind of like receive therapy. You know, you get the support of others. And I think, again, like a big part of like the trends in terms of the issues that students are coming to therapy with is rooted in this sense of isolation. So group therapy, like, kind of addresses that right away. But for students, it can feel like it's the lesser of the two therapies between individual and group therapy. So that can be somewhat of a barrier. But that's one good way to kind of reach more students and kind of help with the ease the burdens of the demands. There's times where like when we're like really heavily hit, like around the time of midterms, because there tends to be a trend where, like, you know, some students are kind of pretty proactive, and these tend to be students who have like a history of mental health struggles, and they kind of come in early in the semester where there's going to be more slots. But most of the time, students come around a time of crisis, and a shared crisis for most students is midterm time, or, you know, finals time, or, you know, right before you have to make the decision to drop a class or withdraw a class or not. And so you got all these students coming in at the same time, and then that drives up the wait list. So in those times of like really heavy traffic, you know, we'll switch from like weekly sessions to kind of like, you know, maybe bi-weekly sessions with clients that can handle that, you know, it'll be okay with them to be seen on a bi-weekly basis as opposed to a weekly basis. So that way it allows us to see twice as many students. So things of that nature. And really, like, also like building up like community referral databases, so students know about like services outside of the university services that could be useful for them. Now, of course, like, it'll be more convenient for the student to be seen on campus. So again, that's not an option that's desirable for a lot of students sometimes, but things like that as well. And of course, like, you could have a group with as many as 10 members in it. So in that way, like, you could see 10 clients, and a group typically lasts hour and a half, 90 minutes. You could see 10 clients in that 90 minutes, in contrast to like seeing one client in a 45 minute session. And so, you know, it's like almost a 5-to-1 type of thing in terms of looking at the time allotted, and how many students you could accommodate. Now, to get 10 clients in your group, that's a really successful group. You know, a lot of times that may not be the case. You may have anywhere from 4 to 6 clients, but still, like, you know, you're still able to maximize that time a lot more. And group psychotherapy is a really kind of like useful mode of psychotherapy. Like,
so in this next clip, we talk about mindfulness practices. Dr. Wallace explains how people can change their anxiety through various mindfulness types of techniques.
I think anxiety is the number one kind of mental health issue just worldwide. Yeah. So this is a very important topic. And in my professional opinion, the number one way, the best way to kind of regulate one's anxiety is to learn how to regulate one's breathing patterns. It's so simple and so effective, but it can be, it's almost so simple, too simple, that people kind of ignore it or just see it as how helpful will that be? But in my opinion, that is the most effective way to regulate one's anxiety. And so just learning how to, like, learning the practice of like deep breathing, deep belly breathing, you know, because when we're feeling anxious, our breathing starts to get more, or tends to be more shallow, or more chest breathing. And so learning how to take a slow, deep breath, a breath in which the belly expands more than the chest expands. And a way a person can practice this is they can just place one hand on their chest, one hand on their belly, and while they breathe, kind of focus on making their hand move more than their hand on their belly move more than the hand on the chest. And just, you know, seeing the air fill up the belly and really taking a nice deep breath. Now, something that's also very interesting is that biologically, if we make our out breath or our exhalation approximately 2 times as long as our inhalation or our in breath, it activates the parasympathetic nervous system, which kind of automatically calms us down. That's our body's way of kind of calming ourselves down. So often, like when, you know, a way to practice this type of breathing is to simply breathe through a straw, because if you're sucking in air through a straw, it'll come in much more quickly than you can blow it out through a straw. So it can kind of train a person to like be able to take a deep breath in, but a nice slow exhalation or out breath. And so those are really great ways to kind of just manage one's anxiety. Like when, whether it's just like a mild case of anxiety or like a panic attack type of anxiety. Now, something else to keep in mind is that the role of the mind in fueling anxiety. Again, it's my opinion that anxiety is most often fueled by kind of like thoughts or overthinking. And it's my belief that, like, in a Western society, at least, there's an over focus on thinking and a lack of focus on like the body, and almost a lack of trust in the body and in the body's ability to kind of like take care of a lot of things for us without our mind having to direct it. You know, just think about it. Like, our body knows how to digest food without our mind having to guide it and control it. But we live in this society with all these demands of thinking and, oh, we got to do this and do that and do the next thing, that we tend to overthink and kind of project into the future too much. And that often is the fuel or the gasoline that fuels the fire of anxiety. So I think it can be useful to kind of like get back to the body, get back to the wisdom of the body. And I think that's a way that breathing works too. Like, it's kind of like a mindfulness practice or a mindfulness meditation to kind of just pay attention to the breath and pay attention to the body. Also, something that I think can be helpful is like when a person's experiencing anxiety or any really strong emotion, rather than kind of like thinking about the feeling and kind of freaking out and kind of like, you know, going to this place of dread, allowing themselves to kind of just like go into the body and kind of almost locate like where that feeling is. So it sounds kind of weird, but like, for example, like let's say a person's feeling sad, rather than thinking about all the things that are making them sad and kind of fueling that feeling and growing it and making it bigger to the point where it may even become overwhelming, it may be more useful to kind of just like, okay, where in my body am I feeling this sadness? Where am I feeling it? Oh, okay, I feel it in my throat. What does it feel like in my throat? And just being mindful to like what the physical sensation is like. And a lot of times, most often, what people find is when they just pay attention to the sensations, they get a better kind of, one, the sensation starts to decrease. And two, they get a better kind of like hold or control of the sensation. Because I also think a fuel for anxiety is kind of unprocessed emotions. So, you know, let's say you're a person who has a tendency to kind of like bury quote unquote bad emotions, sadness, anger, or any kind of emotion that makes you feel uncomfortable. Well, when you bury it and don't think about it, you don't give yourself a chance to kind of experience it or label it. So it just kind of goes underground and just turns into just like this energy, this unprocessed energy that basically that's what anxiety feels like. It's just like feeling too much of something that you can't even understand or name. So the simple fact of like naming your emotion and allowing yourself to be with your emotion, I feel, is something that can kind of reduce anxiety as well. So those are some of my top tips or opinions when it comes to managing anxiety.
And then if someone like doesn't, I'm going to say, seek treatment, ignore the signs, or is in denial, I mean, what is the long-term effect of that?
I think the long-term effect is, it sounds drastic, but death. Like, it's my belief that, like, most diseases, most health issues are rooted in stress. And as I was saying earlier, it's my belief that stress is rooted in kind of like unprocessed emotional experiences that kind of, they don't get a chance to kind of like be fully experienced and kind of just play themselves out as they are naturally designed to do. And so that emotion gets trapped inside and becomes stress. And this stress kind of like eats away at one's health. It drives people to kind of like coping behaviors that often are like negative coping behaviors, such as overconsumption of food, overconsumption of alcohol, overconsumption of illicit drugs, just poor behavioral choices that like put us at risk. So I think that's the true cause. It damages relationships. It causes us to act in ways with the people we're in relationship with that it causes us to act in ways that can be damaging to the relationships, you know? Relationships, the glue of relationships in a way is like communication. But you know, when we're not in contact with what we feel, when we bury what we feel, it interferes with our ability to communicate effectively. It also interferes with our ability to kind of be in contact with ourselves, because our emotions are a huge part of ourselves. If we don't have access to that, that's a huge well of self-knowledge and actual energy that we cut ourselves off from. So it can contribute to kind of fatigue, lack of energy, lack of vitality. So it has huge consequences, in my opinion.
College is a place where students like to experiment. We've all done it. I mean, if you haven't, you'd be lying. And there is so much pressure, whether it's socially, self-inflicted, or peer pressure, for everyone to fit in. And earlier, Dr. Wallace did mention there's always this feeling of social outcasts and the presence of social media. And students are grappling with the idea of not fitting in. And these struggles in modern day society are not a choice.
Yeah, substance abuse can be a real issue on college campuses. Not only substance abuse, but like risky sexual behavior. Because again, like it's a time of experimentation, a time of kind of like figuring out like who you are, what you're into, what, you know? And so I don't think that that's necessarily a problem or a bad thing. But if you have like underlying traumas that you haven't dealt with, if you have levels of stress that are like beyond your capacity to deal with that stress, that's when this kind of normal experimentation can get out of hand. And so, yeah, I definitely have like have experiences with students who kind of like struggling regulating these behaviors or engaging in these behaviors in a way that's like is detrimental to their experience, their college experience. It actually interferes with the college experience. And I think too, like on some college campuses, there can be like even a cultural kind of expectation to kind of not just experiment sexually with alcohol, with substances, but to engage in these activities in an excessive manner, in a harmful manner. And so I think, you know, I've had students who've like felt the pressure of that and didn't like the pressure to do something that innately felt unhealthy, that felt wrong to them. But there is this pressure and this expectation that you're young, you're at college, you're here to party, and you're here to live, to do these things in excess. And, you know, there's also the phenomenon of, like, you know, at the college age between 18 to 22, you know, you feel you're invincible. You don't think anything can happen to you. So, you know, you probably can take more and tolerate more than an older person can, but there can be this sense of, like, invincibility. It can't happen to me, which can get students in trouble as well.
So I guess what I've gotten from this session is, you know, especially now, I think people are openly admitting, or like you said, they're not ashamed of emotional health.
There's clearly nothing to be ashamed of either. So what was different with our parents is we have so many different layers of stress than they did. They might have not had the social supports or the social structures in place, but, you know, social media does not help. I think we always, on a daily, are in this place of performing, pretending to be people we're not. And when you're stressed, you're full of anxiety and you're depressed, to be somebody that you're not takes more of an effort. And so Dr. Wallace is going to explain his ideals around that in this next clip.
Exactly. And how does the social structure impact all the types of stress, mental health situations we talked about?
It's my belief that, like, we as people, like, we're social creatures. We're meant to connect with others. We're meant to have bonds with others. That's, we thrive in that type of environment, that type of system. But, you know, there's been a shift towards individuality, and, like, American culture has always been kind of, like, ruggedly individualistic in a way. But, you know, I'm going to sound like an old fogey right now, but I think social media, it's connecting in a way, right? Because you get to communicate with people this way. You get to see what's going on in other people's life, you know, on one hand. But I think on another hand, it can create a false sense of community, a false sense of connection. You know, there's something about kind of like being in the presence of another person that's like a real thing that we need. Being able to touch a person, being able to kind of like feel their energy, you know what I mean? That, and there's less of that nowadays. Plus, you know, there's this fostering of competition amongst people. There's this sense that, like, there's limited resources that we're all fighting for, and so that can get in the way of connection as well. We have a natural drive to connect. And also just like, you know, the reality of just how children are raised nowadays. Like, you know, there's this focus on getting into a good school. So doing this activity, doing that activity, like, becoming a resume, becoming like what you do as opposed to like who you are. And so I think that shift too has led to kind of like a tendency for students and people in general to judge themselves more, to judge themselves on like their resume, and kind of like, in my opinion, that increase in self-judgment also creates a disconnection from oneself, because you're not just feeling who you are as a person, you're almost stepping outside of yourself and judging yourself from the outside. And I think social media can contribute to that as well.
So just to recap, I want everybody to make sure that when we speak of mental health awareness, we are replacing this illness with wellness practices. You will be challenged in terms of how you view yourself, how people view yourself, and how the world use yourself. That's a lot of layers of complexity. But listen to this. This is really where the lesson the reminder, the inspo comes in. Change cannot happen if you're closed. If you're totally closed off, you don't share, you bottle everything up. If you don't have any spirit of openness to a new way, a new different idea, a new way of expressing yourself, you're not going to change. You're just going to keep doing the same thing over and over and over. You are going to leave this episode knowing that responsibility is a good thing, that you can create the life that you want. And you are going to be responsible for that and know that you can do that. And coming to therapy with that type of spirit is very helpful. And lastly, it's so common. It could be anybody. The trouble is nobody, like myself, I had talked about it earlier. I didn't want to talk about it. And that makes everything worse. There's going to be a point in your life, it happens to everybody, where you're going to hit rock bottom. Something is going to break down. And mental health is just as important as physical health. So you need to remember that and nourish it.
Stress is like a normal, everyday part of life. And it's not necessarily a good or a bad thing. Like, without stress, you know, we probably wouldn't have the motivation to do much of anything. It's stress that drives us to do things. You know, it's what gets us to accomplish things. So stress by itself is not a inherently negative thing, in my opinion. It's when our levels of stress exceed our capabilities to handle that stress, or exceed the supports that we have in our lives. That's when it can become negative. And often that could present itself in the form of anxiety. You know, like, I like to think of anxiety and depression in terms of like energy, right? Like, too much energy, kind of, that's what characterizes anxiety. That too much thinking, too much energy inside of the body that you don't know what to do with, or that you can't understand, this overwhelming feeling, right? Whereas depression is kind of characterized by too little energy, you know, a lack of motivation, a lack of enjoyment, a lack of zest for life, if you will. You're kind of like not even feeling like you're alive at some point. A decrease in hope, a sense of helplessness, you know, a lack of agency. But, you know, that's why I think anxiety and depression can go hand in hand, because you can only be in a high energy state for so long. After a while, you know, you might dip down into like low energy, right? Or you might, because you are so anxious, feel as though like life is too much for you, right? And that feeling of life being too much for you can contribute to you like not accomplishing as much, or not doing as much, or not being able to experience as much of this life as you think you should, which can lead to feelings of depression. So I think they're interrelated as well, but stress is a normal thing. It's a good thing. And as our capacities to handle stress increase and improve, it increases our ability to get the most out of life. Anxiety, depression, all of the so-called mental health disorders that people seek treatment for, they're universal. Everybody has experienced a depression in their lives, or like a sense of like loneliness, isolation, have felt hopeless in their lives before. Now, it may have been just for a brief moment, but it's a universal condition. Anybody can understand that if they allow themselves to. Like, you know, we might not want to allow ourselves to because it doesn't feel good. Everyone has felt anxious before, you know. Everybody's felt like their anxiety has been out of their control before. But some people have been able to bounce back or handle that better, or some people haven't felt like the need to seek services for that. So I say all that to say, anybody who is struggling with any of these things or any other mental health difficulties or emotional difficulties, be wary of diagnosis. I don't even believe in diagnoses. It's just a way to put people in a box. Some people, like, they get a lot of comfort in it, like, oh, what I'm going through has a name, but I think for the most part, it's just a way to categorize people and kind of be human.
Thanks for listening to another edition of the Keep It 100 Girl podcast. Mental health is real, 100 tribe. And as soon as we're born, it lives. It has a pulse. Remember, and I say this to you all the time, we are a product of our environment. Your speed doesn't matter. Forward is forward with getting the right help or treatment. It helps us to brave those storms when we learn how to sail your ship. Connect with Nina on social at Nina Babel on Instagram and Twitter. And if you're on Facebook, you can check out the 100 Tribe by searching for the Keep It 100 Girl podcast page. Watch for me next week because I'm bringing something new, people. All right, so Nina is bringing her triple T next week. And what does that mean, Nina? You're probably saying. But instead of searching the internet, tune in to the launch of my new travel segment called Flyer Girl Talk. And so the whole inspiration behind that title is two things. One, Nina is fly. Two, Nina is a regular flyer. So I matched the two together to bring Flyer Girl Talk. So here's what Nina is going to be giving you. I'm going to be giving my inside travel dish on whether it's destinations, tips, advice. These are insider 100 style insider information. So you don't have to research the internet. All you got to do is tune in weekly to hear all of my dish. And you know what? My whole thing is this. Just don't show up when you take a trip and wing it. Get my insider tips. You don't have to research because I'm going to give it all to you in a bad and bougie kind of way. So you're going to have a good time. Trust and believe. The show debuts May 29th. Be there. This is Nina. I keep it 100. I keep it real and true. Smooches.